It's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Ian James Kidd from the University of Nottingham. Ian works on has a huge range of philosophical interests, including education, science, religion, and the spiritual life, and also has practical and academic interests in social philosophy, especially relating to diversity. His current research is, I think, on epistemic virtue and vice, and virtue in classical Chinese philosophy. And he's going to talk to us today about Taoism, humanity, and the way of heaven. Thank you very much, Ian.
Super. Thanks, Peter, for the introduction. Thank you for having me here. First, does anyone have a copy of the handout? The first three pages are my notes for speaking. On the last page are just a few sections of some descriptions of exemplars from the book of Zhuangzi, for those who don't know them. No need to read them now, just something for you to take away. Okay, so we've had this morning a couple of, if you like, methodological framework papers about cross-cultural, multi-religious philosophies of religion. Here I want to present a case study. So I've got an interest at the moment, developing interest, in the role of exemplarity in the world of religious and spiritual traditions. Obvious feature of all the world's spiritual traditions that I know of, there are always certain persons who exemplify a life of the aspiration to or the attainment of spiritual goods. Saints, sages, gurus, yogis, bodhisattvas, Zen masters, patriarchs, often a variety of kind, usually organized into complex ecclesiastical structures. These play, of course, a variety of roles in religious life, and one thing that I think mainstream analytical philosophy of religion hasn't been so good at in recent years is in attending to these figures, whether, of course, you step into theology and religious studies and anthropology, lots of interest in these figures. And my interest is partly in what would a cross-cultural, pluralistic philosophy of religion look like if we took exemplars as our point of analysis. Here I'm partly informed by some very general work by Lynn Saxebsky on exemplarist moral theory, partly by Victoria's work on spiritual exemplars. And what I want to propose is that one way that we can use exemplars to think pluralistically about religions is to encourage the idea that what's underlying many forms of spiritual life are certain spiritual aspirations. So what I want to hear is a pluralistic account of spiritual exemplarity. I absolutely do not want to speak about exemplars in the singular. They're extremely various in all sorts of ways. For example, if you compare the exemplars from different traditions, Christian, Buddhist, Sikh, etc., they differ in their habits, their values, their lifestyles, their ways of life, their attitudes towards animals, civic participation, their aesthetic preferences, their doctrinal and metaphysical commitments. We desperately want to avoid reductive, simplistic analyses that gloss over the variety of these different types of exemplars. So, for example, my students say, oh, fabulous, so really they're all teaching the same thing. It's all really about unification of the world, or it's all really about compassion. And you want to go for reductive analyses. I want to push here a form of what Michael and Arisa paper called radical pluralism. There is a radical plurality of types of spiritual exemplar. One way that we can distinguish these is by looking at the very different aspirations that inform different conceptions. And extremely tentatively, I think there are at least three general types of spiritual aspiration we can find in the majority of the world's spiritual traditions. First is what I'm going to call an aspiration to allegiance. Here a certain person, maybe Abraham, is going to be exemplary as a model of a life lived in allegiance or devotion or loyalty to, for example, certain divine commands. It's called Thick Abraham's interpreted by Kierkegaard. What is exemplary about him is that guiding his life and his convictions and his actions, including the decision to cause Trump to kill his son, is an allegiance to divine command. That's one type of very general aspiration. It will take different variegated forms within and across traditions. But there's one type. And I think that's extremely different from a second type of aspiration, which I think, for example, you find best in Buddhism, where certain people are exemplars of a life lived in enlightened insight into certain deep truths about the world. So think about, for example, the noble truths in Buddhism. These truths are noble because a deeply cultivated understanding of those truths spontaneously transforms a person's perception, feeling, attitudes, and comportment towards the world. So for Buddhists, you don't understand the truth of the no-self doctrine until you are spontaneously transformed and adopt certain compassionate forms of commitment. Because to understand the truth of that doctrine is to be transformed in how one lives. And that's, I think, a feature of many of the Buddhist exemplars that we can find. But here, there's no obedience to divine commands. The relationship, the normative relationship to those noble truths is not one of obedience or loyalty. But there are different forms of obedience and loyalty within ranks. Well, that's not the fundamental phenomenological structure of that aspiration. So there are at least two. Well, the third one that I want to focus upon here in detail is an aspiration to emulation. Here, a person is exemplary insofar as they are a model of a human life which is guided or shaped by the effort to emulate certain features of the grounds or the source of the world. This one I think is harder to spot because I don't think it's as present in the world's major spiritual traditions. But think here, an example I like, of Stoicism. Now, Stoicism is often termed as a spiritual tradition. And in Stoicism, of course, you have famously a very complex conception of what ultimately grounds and animates the world, which is the Logos. The Logos is perfectly rational, providential, it orders the cosmos, the benefit of all beings. And then, of course, you have a certain conception of the Stoic sage, as described and maybe as exemplified by Marcus Aurelius. And there are striking parallels between the qualities attributed to the Logos and to the virtues of the Stoic sage. The Stoic sage is also perfectly, or at least superlatively rational, disciplining their passions. They too are providential. They work to order their own life, or perhaps the empire as a whole, for the good of all the beings and creatures who live in it, apart from the Germanic tribes to the north. And of course, they too are also teleological and providential. As Marcus says, the sage can always say at every moment what is in his mind and the reasons he has for acting as he does. And here I take it there is a particular type of intimate relation between the Stoic sage and the Logos, the grounds or the source of the world of experience as it's conceived. In this case, I think the sage is emulating certain excellent features of the cosmos. And this, I want to say, is a further distinctive type of spiritual aspiration, the aspiration to emulate the excellent features of the grounds or the source of the cosmos, and taking this as an ideal for a good life. What I offer here is a case study of how I think this plays out in early Taoism. I think early Taoism, particularly in the book of Zhuangzi, offers one of the most sophisticated developments of this aspiration. I've not only here sketched some of its general features, this is very much work in progress, but hopefully I can persuade you that there is indeed this aspiration to emulation. There is a form of it in Taoism, and if so, we have a distinctive conception of a spiritual or religious life, interestingly different from what will be familiar from the main religions typically focused upon in the philosophy of religion. Now, what am I meaning here by early Taoism? Well, there are at least two classic works in early Taoism. There is, of course, the Tao Te Ching and the Book of Zhuangzi. Now, these are very different from one another, not just in their literary style, but also in their conceptions of the Tao itself, of human beings' relationship to it. They differ in their arguments, their concerns, and their structures. But one thing that these two texts do share in common is that they present to us a variety of different types of exemplary figures who are, in their idiom, on the way, or attuned to Tao, and whose lives are exemplary or outstanding for that reason. Reading through those texts, I think there are actually at least five types of exemplars. So already we have internal pluralism. There isn't a class of Taoist exemplars. There is a variety of very, very different figures presented to us as models of a life on the way. So the first, maybe the most popular, are those who I think A.C. Gray nicely calls knack masters. Persons, often ordinary practical folks, engaged in activities like carving, swimming, and butchering. These are people who exemplify their particular insight into the way in their supple, easy, spontaneous forms of practical comportment. So Cook Ding, for example, the butcher, whose skill is so immaculate that he stands before the ox and then suddenly it lies dismembered at his feet to the awe of all, who perceive it as daemonic and astonishing. Or a particular man presented to us in chapter 19 of the Zhuangzi, who is preternaturally accomplished at swimming. The scene where Confucius encounters him, this turbid pool, churning water so much even the fish can't swim in it. This man dives in, suddenly appears, they think he's drowning himself, and Confucius asks him, how do you do this? Do you have a way? And he says, no, I simply enter with the inflow and exit with the outflow. And the old man says, I just follow the way of the water. I don't impose upon it. So here are one type of Taoist exemplars, the knack masters, those who evince their attunement to the Tao through forms of spontaneous, supple, responsive, practical comportment. Second type, more so from the Tao Te Ching in its later sections, are the sage kings, historical or legendary figures like the Yellow Emperor of old. They too have this power to have a supple, recessive, responsive influence over the things around them. They show their attunement to the Tao on a grand scale. So there's a second type. Third, there are what I'll just call philosophical sages, figures like Zhuangzi himself. Sages, Shengren, who are philosophically reflective and attuned and are concerned to reflectively explore their relationship to the Tao. Zhuangzi himself, the best example. I think in some of the later Taoist writings, we also get a fourth class, which is certain creative artists, painters and poets, people like Wang Bing. People who have that spontaneous understanding and insight into the Tao expressed through their creative works, particularly, of course, poetry and landscape painting. And then maybe a fourth group of Taoist exemplars, particularly from the book of Lao Tzu,
where it's often children and certain types of animal that are presented to us as models of a life attuned to Tao. Because often what those children and animals have in common is a certain type of unsophisticated, uncontrived, innocent spontaneity that is understood to be in some relevant sense emanate of the Tao itself. Of course, as children grow up, they become initiated into a complex artificial adult world and they lose this. So maybe also certain children and animals presented to us as models of a life of attunement. So here already we have a diversity of types, but I just want to hear to speak about philosophical sages. So we have a variety of a various cast of characters and presented to us as models of a life attuned to the Tao, who we might be invited to emulate. And what all of these things are doing in their very, very different ways, through practical activities, through ruling or through governing, or simply through going about doing the things that children and animals do, is that they follow the way of heaven and therefore join with the world and enjoy a type of spontaneous, unencumbered, flexible living that is identified with a good human life. Now, in the Tao Te Ching, there are characterizations of these types of figures, but that text has at least, I think, two limitations. First, there aren't the dense, detailed descriptions of the character and the comportment of these exemplary figures, partly, of course, fitting in the literary style of the text, famously sparse, poetic, and elusive. But you don't have, then, the detailed descriptions of the everyday conduct, habits, moods, feelings, behaviors, interactions, ways of life of those figures, the dense portraits you would need in order to emulate them. And second, I don't think you have the complex stipulation of certain types of emulative practices, the practices you would engage in order to cultivate this attunement or harmony. You do, of course, have the central complex notion of wu-wei, of a sort of unforced actionless action. But in a sense, what we want is much more complex, specified practices. So here, of course, we have two things. First, we need concrete models, densely described, of what people who live on the way are like, and then a set of practices, spiritual practices, that enable people to actually develop those capacities. And I want to suggest that the Book of Zhuangzi has both of those things in spades. Now, in the Zhuangzi, the term used to describe these figures who are on the way is shenren, variously rendered as the true, authentic, or genuine persons. It will partly depend upon your translation. For those of you who know your text, I'm mainly using the A.C. Graham and the Brooks Porin translations. Now, these shenren, again, take very many forms. So you have Kukding, and you have the old man swimming I described, you have the cicada catcher, and you have several other figures. Now, a characteristic of all of them that helps to make them true or genuine persons is this complex thing called spontaneity. Now, the term spontaneity functions in different ways in the Taoist texts. Here, I'm not going to say that it's necessarily a single virtue. It might, in fact, be a cluster of virtues and different capacities, but it's this spontaneity that a person needs if they are to attune themselves to Tao. And what I want to suggest is that by engaging in certain emulative practices, certain persons can come to acquire virtues of spontaneity, and insofar as they do acquire these virtues, they are successfully emulating certain features of Tao itself, figuratively rendered. In that case, there are parallels then between the qualities or aspects of Tao and the virtues of the sage. In order to develop those parallels in a complex emulative way, one engages in certain practices. So what sorts of qualities, what virtues of spontaneity do these figures have? Well, I think there's a cluster of sub-virtues of spontaneities. But one will be a sort of supple, alert responsiveness to things. So we're told, for example, that the sage doesn't follow a fixed course. The shenren will adapt to the changing needs, preferences, and sensibilities of things. They don't follow rigid plans and guidelines, fixed routines, techniques, and schedules. Instead, they follow along with the rightness of each thing in itself, unconstrained by forms of artifice. So the reason that the Taoists are very critical of Confucians is that what Confucians tend to introduce are forms of artifice, goals, plans, projects, purposes, techniques, specifications, prescriptions, various forms of normative instruction that tend to solidify or rigidify people's natural responsiveness to things. The sage, the shenren, is one who can overcome these, and insofar as they do, they acquire a supple responsiveness, and this is understood to be emulative of the Tao. Tao itself has no plans, purposes, perspectives, or goals or objectives. Tao gives forth many things, characterized aquatically as a spring or a source of all of these different ways. But of course, like water, will adapt to and change the goals. In fact, the aquatic metaphors are extremely effective at characterizing certain virtues. Tao is like water. It flows around things. It doesn't obstruct them. It moves around and adapts. It takes the shape of the things it's put into it. bucket, cup, and mouth. And in these senses, then, there are emulative parallels between the goalless flexibility of the stage and this open expansiveness of the Tao. So there's one set of virtues of spontaneity, supple, alert responsiveness, an ability not to be distracted by external noises. A second is a certain quality of flow or spontaneity. So again, here playing on those aquatic characterizations, Taoists like comparing the Tao itself to a river, which flows and transforms. It's constantly altering and transforming itself, but at the same time, renewing itself, over tones of Heraclitus here. And in so doing, ensures its health, its vitality, and its stability, like the spring constantly bubbling up, giving forth different ways which themselves change and transform. And this is mirrored again in the character and the comportment and the practice of various Taoist sages. These two have a flow and a constancy. The Taoist sage, not spontaneous in the sense of performing random acts of caprice and just going wherever the wind takes them. They're not aimless in this sense, but their life has that gentle, slow, constant responsiveness to things. They have their own way through the world, partly governed by their interactions with other things, non-obstructive, non-aggressive, and non-contending. So we're told that the music of the Yellow Emperor, famous for its beauty, was flowing unforced and uncontrived, and in that music, we're told, you can hear, in a sense, the Tao itself playing out. So there's another set of virtues of spontaneity, a flow and a constancy that makes a human life a good life. And then finally, another set of virtues of spontaneity. So when Taoists compare to water, sometimes the metaphor is pushed in different ways. Water doesn't just flow and transform and adapt to things and take shape. Of course, water also nourishes things. Water gives life. It waters. And in that sense, so too, it's said, does the Zhenren also adapt this function of the Tao. So the sage, we're told, is nourishing and nurturing. The sage will recognize the needs and natures of the different things and creatures who may interact with, and they're trying to nourish these, to sensitize themselves to the mandates of different creatures, recognizing what is necessary and appropriate to them, and drawing this out and cultivating them, helping them to accomplish their own mandates by being alert to the portents of their transformations. So here a certain set of virtues of attention, sensitivity, and concern, motivated by a desire to nourish, nurture, and cultivate. Part of what Taoists is, of course, so fond of the image of themselves as gardeners. The good gardener is one who is sensitive to the needs and natures of plants, flowers, and things around them, changing of the seasons, when things need watering, pruning, and trimming, cultivating and realizing the natures of things. So there is a set of virtues, then, typically exemplified by Zhenren, which have this parallel quality to certain features of Tao. Non-aggressive, non-contending, spontaneous, supple, responsiveness, not rigidly driven by goals and purposes and projects, no desire to impose and control and dominate, an openness not only to one's own way of life, but also to the ways and the needs of other sorts of creatures as well. And we could develop these parallels in other ways and sort of just list Taoist virtues and then try to pair them off against certain aspects or qualities of the Tao. I won't do that here, partly because we'd have to talk much more about metaphor. And we have Victoria in the room who has a splendid paper on metaphors in Chinese philosophy. So I'm going to push those questions in that direction. But instead, I want to ask the practical question. Thinking one feature of any spiritual tradition is the provision of a certain set of practices for the cultivation and the maintenance and the expression of one's spiritual dispositions and sensibilities. And the early Taoists have a variety of practices, many of which would be unfamiliar. For example, there are complex practices of worship, for instance. That is not the appropriate attitude one should take towards the Tao. But they have at least two distinct emulative practices whose purpose, as I take it, is not just to ensure that one's life is happy, harmonious, and fairly chilled out. These are emulative practices which enable people to cultivate certain virtues by emulating Tao. And I'm partly here drawing upon a recent paper by David Cooper, who gives these two examples. So the first is a complex type of practice, yo, usually rendered as wandering or roaming, not only in the sense of literal perambulation, although that was important for the Taoists. Rather, wandering and roaming refers to a particular active self-directed effort on the part of a person to try to free themselves from confinement within a single way of experiencing and responding to the world. Because we're usually born into and inherit a certain way of experiencing, responding, evaluating, interacting, and assessing things. The problem is with human beings that we have an additional capacity to become aware that we inhabit a particular way of experiencing the world, and that with a certain amount of effort and critical self-reflection, our perspective on the world can become porous, We can't disengage from it and occupy an aperspectival position. That's not a capacity we have. But we can transform our relationship to our perspective so that it becomes appropriately porous or transparent, so that we can then imaginatively enter into and explore alternative ways of experiencing and responding with the world. So one strategy for doing this that Zhuangzi is very fond of is to compare human and animal perspectives. So as an act of preparation, I tried to do this last week and try to work out what this would be like. So sitting in one of the beautiful gardens in the University of Nottingham campus, watching a gigantic slug crawling across the path. Now, I'm an animal lover, but I'm not fond of slugs. And looking at the creature, I found it to be just fat and slimy and horrible. But then I looked up and there was, a thrush sitting on a branch above me. The thrush was, of course, eyeing the slug. And I could imagine for a moment, from the thrush's perspective, that's not a fat, slimy, disgusting thing that I'm just going to hope doesn't come near me. That's a juicy morsel. Indeed, that's exactly how the thrush is perceiving it, because then it swoops down and poor slug is no more. But that would be one small exercise in which you try to enter into alternative schemes of valuation. Within my certain way of experiencing the world, the slug is not food, it's not attractive, it doesn't fit within an inherited scheme of aesthetic valuation I have for animals. It's slimy and horrible. It's not a beautiful creature, but then you become aware of just how entrenched in your perspective are these aesthetic evaluations. Is it a pet to cuddle and nurture and cosset and hug, or is it a pest to be trapped and poisoned and killed? Is it an animal that you will whack with a newspaper as soon as you see it, that casual killing of insects that's so common these days, especially in this weather, or could it be something else? So this is one practice, constitute this activity of wandering, not just becoming aware that you occupy a certain perspective, but trying to imagine yourself into the perspective of other creatures. And if one can do this, says Zhuangzi, through these small acts of reverie and reflection, you acquire this capacity, not just to, as it were, perceive the perspective of other creatures, other ways, but a capacity then to roam or wander between them, to, at least to some limited degree, think yourself into the perspective of other things, to gain different ways of perceiving and understanding and experiencing and responding to the world. And if you can do this, says Zhuangzi, you'll gain an important capacity. You will, as he says, arrive up at the vastness at the root of things. You arrive up beyond all of these ways to the source of all of those ways, to the Tao itself. And then he says, you acquire a certain sort of expansiveness that is in itself a certain property of the Tao. You've escaped from your confinement in a single way of experiencing and responding to the world. Instead, explore the variety of other ways, not all of them, of course, but many of them. And then you'll get this sense of what it is that gives all of these ways. So there's one emulative practice, which is wandering or roving, consisting in self-directed actions, making people aware of the particularity and contingency and the limitations of their own perspective. A second is fasting of the heart-mind, and unfortunately here I can't pronounce the Chinese. But fasting of the heart-mind, this is a particular, again, type of self-directed disciplined practice, where a person tries to still or silence or quiet or nullify what Zhuangzi takes to be an important feature of human beings. He says we have a profound disposition to order and classify and control and rubricate different things. Now he says, of course, all creatures do this. They'd have to in order to have a world at all. They'd have to make discriminative judgments. But he says what's distinctive of human beings is that we have a tendency to reify or objectify these judgments. We regard our classifications and discriminations not as what they are, as pragmatic artifacts suited to our particular natures and needs, but as delineating objective schemes of values. The problem is, he says, that when we tend to do this, the results tend to be extremely injurious to the other creatures. For example, the ones that we classify as ugly or as disgusting or as pests, things to be trapped and killed and caged and branded and burned and destroyed. So he says the idea of fasting of the heart-mind is not to remove these discriminations and judgments, but rather to remove a certain type of attitude that human beings are disposed to form towards those evaluations and attitudes, to regard them as delineating an objective layout of values. These really are ugly, disgusting creatures. Therefore, they really do deserve to be trapped, killed, or removed. And probably the best description of this, given the book of Zhuangzi, it's an explanation given by the bell stand maker, who's been employed to make a bell stand, and his productions are so outstanding, people ask him, how do you do this? This is on page 4 of the handout, but I won't go through all the details. But the bell stand maker describes this process, what it means to still or fast the heart mind. He says, even before I step into the forest, because I have my commission in mind to make a bell stand for remembering. He says, before I go in, he says, I will reflect upon the whole array of conventions, imperatives, pressures, and expectations built into me. I will reflect upon clumsiness and craft, upon skill and contumacy. I'll begin to become aware of my various motivations, conscious or unconscious or submerged, to be impressive, to wow my competitors, to advance the craft, to produce something wonderful, to produce something I'm proud of. He says, and you begin to, as it were, lay out all of these different impulses and dispositions feeding into you that are trying in their various ways to constrain or narrow or channel your creative spontaneous activity. Then he says, by laying them out, which he says the process that takes several days, you can start to still and then to quiet them. He says, and then in this way, he says, they've, as it were, had their say, and then I can remove them and silence them. And then, he says, only then do I step into the forest. He says, the outside world slides away. All thought of rank, prestige, wealth, status, being impressive, fall away. And he says, only then can I view the inborn heavenly nature of the trees. Because now, he says, I will be experiencing them as they are, undistorted by my desire to find that tree that will make a really, really impressive bell stand. That tree which has really, really wet, rare wood that will impress people. He says, my creative spontaneous activity will no longer be distorted, as it once was, by a variety of extrinsic pressures. So there then are sketches of two emulative practices, wandering and this fasting of heart-mind. Now one thing I'm very unsure about at the moment is whether these practices are themselves emulation, like when you're wandering, that's when you're doing the emulating. Or rather, is it that by engaging in these practices, you clear away obstacles to emulation? So these are sort of preparatory for it. I genuinely am unsure about the answer to this right now. I'm actually leaning towards the idea that by engaging in wandering and fasting, you're sort of clearing the way so that a process of emulation can then begin, perhaps spontaneously. Others try to persuade me that these are in fact emulative themselves. I don't know this, I'd welcome your thoughts on that. But certainly, whichever those possibilities it is, the purpose of these practices is to enable people to develop certain virtues of spontaneity, suppleness, adaptability, responsiveness, a freedom from rigid goals, purposes, and preconceptions that would distort the exercise of creativity and spontaneity by human beings. And I think that it is this emulative relation that underlies the relationship, at least in the Zhuangzi, between Tao and the Zhen Ren. So reading the various commentators who try to explore this relationship, people like Lydia Cohn, Brian Van Norden, Roger Ames and others, they use a very, very diverse vocabulary of correlations, analogues, modelling oneself on, following along with. They talk about analogies and continuities between Tao and the Zhen Ren. But I think that all of these lack the direct and the intimate character of the relationship that's going on here. These aren't analogues or correlations, you know, two trains going on separate tracks in the same direction. This is a much more intimate, direct, personal relationship. Because what's being taken as a model here for a certain form of exemplary human life is Tao itself, not by way of analogy or correlation, but by way of direct emulation. I think the scholar who comes closest to this I'm aware of is Roger Ames. So he remarks that Taoist exemplarity involves, quote, emulation of the natural order broadly. Hence their grand analogy between the conduct of the Zhen Ren, the chief human being, and the harmony achieved in the mutual accommodations of natural phenomena. Now I think that's pretty close as far as it goes, but I think the relationship is emulative and not analogical. And what's being emulated are not natural processes changing in the seasons. What's being emulated is the source of those natural processes, which is Tao. So the relationship here is much closer and much more intimate. Now, if that's right, then at this point so far, we have a certain conception of a spiritual exemplarity, here grounded not in anything like allegiance or devotion or loyalty to the Tao. These concepts are alien to Taoist tradition. This is not a relationship of worship or obedience. There's no divine commands and there are no prophets. There are no rituals of worship. Nor is this part of what I call the aspiration to enlightened insight. There is a certain dimension of that, of course. But the relationship that the Zhen Ren have to the Tao is not necessarily a direct insight. For one thing, many of the Zhen Ren deny that they have any such insight. So many of them, when questioned, do you have a way? They say, I have no way. So the swimmer, for example, says, I don't have a way, because I was born in the water and I've adapted to it. He says, I just follow the way of the water. Many of them deny and proscribe anything like enlightened insight. Zhuangzi, famously, is extremely skeptical about the importance and role of systematic philosophical reflection. So So I don't think we can characterize this as just another form of the aspiration to enlightened insight. I think this is very much emulation, because emulation captures that intimate relationship. And it's that effort to gain a certain type of intimate integration or unity or connectedness to the grounds or the source of the world that justifies our thinking about this as a form of religious life. And of course, the etymology of the term, religare, to seek for a connectedness or a rootedness with the grounds or the source of the world. Now, in some traditions, that sort of rootedness is obedience or allegiance, but not in this tradition. The relationship here is emulative. Now, if that's right, then we could look at Taoism as a potentially attractive form of spiritual exemplarity, one of a range of different types of exemplarity. But what I want to do here, instead of continuing to gloss and develop this account to make it sound more attractive, instead I kind of want to go in the other direction and actually urge a certain type of caution that will probably arise. Because I think for many people, Taoism, even if people know very little about it, they will tend to have quite positive images of Taoism. For whatever reason, Taoism seems to have good press. It's very typical for people who write books on Taoism to note and then lament that there is a very rosy, romantic images of what Taoist sages tend to be. Sort of long-haired, open necks, wandering barefoot along the riverbanks, singing songs, happy, merry, attuned to nature, at one with the birds and the beasts. Now, of course, this sort of image has various advantages, but one problem is that it's arguably disconsistent with a lot of what's actually being said in the Taoist text about the typical state of human life. So Eskimolgod, I think, rather persuasively argues that if you actually set aside this cheerful, romantic image and actually look at the descriptions of the typical forms of human life of those people who are not on the way, it is, he says, quite bleak, dark, and misanthropic. So the characterization of human life, the overwhelming majority of people who are not attuned to the Tao, who are not following the way of heaven, says the lives of these people is typically miserable. It says they're constantly fluctuating between worried and sad. They're constantly busy and scurrying around, even when they're at rest, constantly preoccupied with plans, goals, purposes, agendas. They're always trying to impose their ways upon other things, then being pushed back. So the overwhelming vision of human life in the Zhuangzi is arguably quite misanthropic. It says you have all these various depressing phenomena like egoism, jealousy, frustration, and so on, which are not superficial features of human life, but they seem sunk into the very, very features of the world. In that case, we have reason to think that perhaps there is a slightly darker or more unattractive dimension to Taoist exemplarity. I think that one way that this misanthropy or darkness shows itself is when we actually look at a particular type of objection to which emulative traditions, the sort I described, are always vulnerable. And this is the charge that these traditions are fundamentally inhuman in their aspiration, or at least the way that the aspiration to emulation typically plays out leads to a certain form of inhumanity. For the reason that the fundamental object or model for the ideal, authentic, genuine human life is, of course, something characteristically inhuman. So Tao, for example, the Logos, these are not personal beings with a complex internal affective economy. They don't have moods, feelings, dispositions. There are no familial relationships. These are not models of arguably, of a human life at all. These are abstract, ineffable, and impersonal. I mean, in Chinese philosophy, this objection was raised very, very early on by Xunzi. He said, Zhuangzi was blinded by nature and insensible to men. Where insensible to men means, I think, insensible, lacking a sense of the importance to human beings of a variety of moral, emotional, and existential phenomena. In this case, he says, if we try to take that as a model, we're going to have a very unattractive ideal of human life. And of course, for Xunzi, as a good Confucian, part of what Zhuangzi is insensible to is the importance of, for example, culture, learning, knowledge, edification, familiar relationships, interpersonal connectedness, participation in the state. These things are constitutive of a human life. And insofar as a human life lacks these things, that life is lacking and impoverished. And if your spiritual aspiration is urging you to abandon those things or to downplay them, and instead try to emulate something detached, impersonal, and ineffable, you're not going to have a richly existentially satisfying model for a human life, in which case you're not in the exemplarist business. So Eric Nelson recently argues that Zhuangzi ignores the properly human, precisely for the reason that he upholds the supremacy of an indifferent, impersonal, and fatalistic Tao. And of course, it's not just Zhuangzi who's open to this objection. Epicurus also, I think, has a form of this emulative aspiration. He urges us to emulate the equanimity and the tranquility of the gods. There is that very famous, very disturbing section where Epicurus is trying to describe to us what it's like to live and think and feel as one of these equanimitus exemplars. And he says, they will be like a god. He says, they will be like someone standing on a vast cliff, looking over a vast battlefield, looking down on thousands of men, roaring and screaming, hacking their limbs off, wading in their blood, the air filled with terrors and screams they have. And the best person will look down on this, he says, as the gods do, unblinking and unmoving and unfeeling, glad only that this is not them, and happy that they will never be moved by this scene of horror. Now that, of course, is another form of the inhumanity objection. Whatever that would be an inhuman way of responding to such a scene of human carnage. So the inhumanity objection applies to many traditions and not just to Taoism. But I think it is particularly, Taoism particularly vulnerable because it's not difficult to find sections in these texts that would seem to confirm the inhumanity charge. For example, remarks like, forgetting the human makes you a man of the heavenly. If you want to follow the way of heaven, you have to leave behind or abandon certain features of what it means to be human. I think maybe the best example of this is the famous description in chapter 18 of Chuang-tzu's response to the death of his wife. At a certain point, his wife dies, and this is on the page 4 of the handout if you want the full version, and one of his friends goes naturally and understandably to console him. And he finds Chuang-tzu sitting on the floor of his house, singing loudly, banging on a drum. And his friend is horrified. He says, this person was your wife, you spent a life with her, you raised children with her. And his frustration is not that he's not obeying the proper Confucian mourning rituals. He says, this is just an inhuman way to respond to this. You formed a complex, nourishing, long-term, sustained relationship with this person, and on the day that she's died, you're here singing and drumming as if it's any other day. He says, this is humanly unacceptable as a mode of life. And that is where it sets up the charge of inhumanity. But then Zhuangzi's response to this, which I reproduce in form above, might tend to confirm the charge, because Zhuangzi's response is that, well, of course, initially I was very sad, and initially I wailed and I sobbed. But then he says, this is the condensed version, then I realized that before she existed, she was only form. And then before that form existed, she was only energy. And before the energy existed, it took other forms and other creatures, and will continue to do so well into the future, and has always come to exist. And then he says, I realized that placing that larger context, her death is actually just one of an ongoing series of transformations of form and energy in the world, sustained and generated by Tao, as was and always will be. Which, when I ran this by my students, just seemed to underscore the charge of inhumanity. Like, this is not the way that you would respond to the death of your partner. To this very, very complex metaphysical drama, which one of my students said just seems to be evading the issue. In which case, it's not difficult to find material from the Book of Zhuangzi which seems to confirm, in quite dramatic ways, the charge of inhumanity. Like, if this is the ideal of Taoist exemplarity, at least the exemplar I call the philosophical sage, this is might be exemplary, but not as a form of human life. There is something fundamentally inhuman in this. Now, coming to the end of this paper, I can't here fully respond to this. What I want to do simply is to urge caution about rushing into the conclusion that cosmic emulation, whatever you want to call it, necessarily confirms or supercharges the charge of inhumanity for at least two reasons. Firstly, just an observation is that if we actually think back to the variety of Taoist exemplars that I listed, many of them are still engaged in forms of human life and practice. So the old image of Taoist sages living alone as hermits in the mountains, we know this is false, partly from the archaeological evidence. Some of them did, there's a people live off in the mountains, but most of them were literally and metaphorically on the edges of human society. So think about some of the Nak masters I described. They are carpenters and swimmers and bell stand makers and butchers. They're engaged with forms of human life and practice. They are still involved with the human world. There's no strong sense that you have to evacuate yourself from the human world in order to achieve this. Certainly there's no evidence in the text, I think, that you have to do this. The second more important reason is that there are actually other passages in the Zhuangzi you can point to which indicate a reciprocity, a mutually reinforcing quality between the human and the heavenly. For example, when we are warned in the inner chapters, to be a genuine human being, a Zhen Ren, neither the human nor the heavenly must win out over the other. So that sort of competition and imbalance is precisely what we're trying to avoid. We're told the Yellow Emperor's music was performed with the human, but attuned to the heavenly. Part of the reason it was so outstanding is that it was not simply a performance of human practice, it was attuned to the heavenly, informed, resonating with, and responsive to the wider order of things. That's partly why it was so outstanding. So So the thought there seems to be that certain forms of human practice can be enhanced to a substantive degree by their attunement to Tao. Again, we're warned in the outer chapters, to insatiably partake of the heavenly, we must not neglect the human. Again, the idea being that we shouldn't be imposing artificial discriminations and separating things. Ideally, what the sage does is to spontaneously bring things together, and in particular, very, very importantly, by honouring their own essence. So if the Tao gives to things their own essences, needs, and natures, well, one thing that's distinctive, arguably, to human beings is that we have this sort of meta-capacity to identify that we have a particular way of responding to things, that we alone of all the creatures can become aware of the wider context of our existence. So where Zhongzi says that fish, for example, are confined to their little worlds. The fish can only survive in that particular type of environment and have very little discernment from what's going on beyond it. So human beings are not like this. We have this peculiar, almost amphibious quality that we can apprehend the wider situation and make a decision to gain or to lose the way. So as A.C. Graham confirms, it's only human beings who can lose the way. Other creatures are confined to their own natures, needs, essences. They will play out their own existences in this way. But human beings can forsake the way. Again, playing on the metaphor of a way, which is in Victoria's article. What is a way? Well, a way can be followed, but a way can be strayed from. And a way can be lost, and you can lose the way, and you can forget the way. You can be dragged away from the way by imperatives and pressures and ideologies and so on. So human beings have, as it were, a choice to follow the way to follow the way of heaven or to abandon and lose it. And part of the misanthropy, I think, that Mulgott points to is that so much of the artificial human world is designed to drag us away from the way, to lock us into economic imperatives, selfish, invidious, narrow concerns. And the very charming remark at the very end, it is in fact the radiance of heaven that reveals the humanness of the human. The idea being there, I take this, that part of what makes for a genuinely accomplished, exemplary human life is not that you've left behind the human, but that you have enriched and extended the humanly with the heavenly. It's only when your life is following the way of heaven that you're truly living as an authentic human being. Now, I think that's an evocative thought, but it can be very, very difficult to get a handle on this. So I want to end now with one last point, asking, well, okay, but what does that look like in practice? If you are following the way of heaven, okay, so you can still be engaged in ordinary human activities. You can go fishing and swimming and bell stand making, whatever it wants you do. And obviously you can have wives and friends and partners. I mean, Johnson was not an isolate living in the mountains. So what then would it look like? What would be an example of someone following the way of heaven, honouring the human, but following the heavenly? An example I think of at the moment is actually returns to Zhuangzi's wife. And it's inspired by some remarks from Amy Olberding in a paper on sorrow and grief in the Zhuangzi. And this is, in a sense, also Amy's question. She said, well, what would be an exemplary way, a sage-like way of responding to grief? Says, do sages feel grief? Do they feel remorse? They form romantic relationships, as Zhuangzi did. Now, of course, the inevitable consequence of romantic relationships is the permanent possibility of forever separation from the objects of your affections. In that case, the possibility of grief and sorrow is built into those relationships, in which case, how does the sage respond? What is, as it were, exemplary grieving? And reflecting on the episode I described with Zhuangzi's wife, and how he tries to explain how it is that he can be singing and drumming and so on in an inhuman way, Amy suggests this, that Zhuangzi, in his grief, accepts the norm of nature, where nature is standing in for, take it the Tao. So the norm of nature is that emotion that's visited upon us by our events and our own constitutions as creatures who care about one another. So it's part of our own particular ways of living that we do form attachments to other people, a variety of forms, close, personal, sustaining ones. That's built into the sorts of creatures we are. That is a human thing to do. It's not exclusive to us. But of course, that is an important part of what we are. And to honour our own natures, our own mandates, means that we form and sustain these relationships. Zhuangzi is entirely happy to accept that. What he rejects, Amy proposes, is a norm of society. Certain artificial, constrained, confining ways of expressing grief and sorrow. For example, the Confucian ritual practices, which will dictate and regiment the process of grieving. What you should feel and for how long and when and how you should behave. Insensitive, totally insensitive, to the moods, feelings that you're actually experiencing. Indifferent to the particularities of your own relationship to the dead, and also to your affective and moral and existential responses. So she goes on, he rejects the norm of society, the grief practices that inhibit the free acceptance of mortality, and thereby the flourishing of a human life. So maybe there then is one example of what it means to honor the human, but also attune yourself to the heavenly. You identify what is natural to a human being, the sorts of creatures that we are in our native states, and you honor and respect those. Because what you're honoring and respecting are the mandates, the needs, the natures given to you by Tao. That is what it means to honor the heavenly. What you're rejecting are certain forms of artifice, conventions, pressures, structures, regimentations of human life, experience, and feeling imposed upon us by those nasty Confucians, and by the tendency of human beings to just form these sorts of structures and norms, which may initially have had some value, but over time become emotionally and existentially straitjacketing, forcing and confining us to feel grief in certain ways. For example, I take in this culture, it's still prescribed to express relief that certain aged relatives have died. For many people, that's entirely natural and entirely understandable. But what you want, says Zhuangzi, is to acknowledge certain heaven-given facts about yourself, that we form these attachments and we will feel grief and sorrow. But then what is crucial is to ensure that the natural grief and sorrow that we experience is expressed and realized in certain authentic, spontaneous ways, not the ones that are imposed or expected of us. So maybe that would be one example, and I'm offering this tentatively. Maybe that's one example of what it means to actually follow with the way of heaven, but still honor what it is that's human. Now, if that's the case, then what's going to be really, truly exemplary for Zhuangzi is not following the way of heaven. It's going to be balancing and harmonizing the human and the heavenly in a lived human life. If so, then here you have a particular conception of spiritual exemplarity, where a human life is lived in full awareness of the wider cosmic context of a human life, but still honors and nourishes and nurtures what is distinctive about human beings. In that case, the ideal is not following the way of heaven. The ideal would be following the way of heaven in a way that still realizes and respects and honors what is distinctively and fundamentally human. Thank you.